KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jenny Asarno. More African Americans are in jail, in prison, on probation, or on parole than were slaves in 1850. More black men are denied the right to vote today than in 1870. It's because they're felons. When Michelle Alexander looks at those facts, she comes to this conclusion. America's criminal justice system is the new Jim Crow. That's right, she says the criminal justice system is a racial caste system. And she says it's not an accident. She argues that the end of legal segregation led to the racial politics of the 1980s, and she says those racial politics led to the war on drugs, which resulted in the explosion of America's prison population. Michelle Alexander is a professor at Ohio State University's Law School and the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. The Gates Public Service Law Program brought Michelle Alexander to the University of Washington on April 13, 2010.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share with you my work and my passion in life, which is working to end the history of racial caste in America. Using a term like racial caste may seem odd today, given the election of Barack Obama. Conversations and debates about race are, you know, typically dismissed as yesterday's news, not much relevant to the current era. We're frequently told by media pundits and politicians alike that we've, as a nation, have finally moved beyond race. And not just in the United States, but around the world, there is the sense that the United States has finally triumphed over race with the election of Barack Obama, and that his election represents kind of the final nail in the coffin of Jim Crow. My book is a direct challenge to that racial narrative. It's intended as a wake-up call. I argue that racial caste is not dead. It is alive and well in America. The mass incarceration of poor people of color in the United States operates like a racial caste system. The systematic targeting of people of color, often at young ages, branding them as felons, and then ushering them into a permanent second-class status, one that they occupy for life, functions now in our society much in the same way that Jim Crow once did. And, you know, I'm well aware that this kind of claim may strike some people as bordering on absurd. You know, I mentioned in the introduction to my book that I myself dismiss the idea that something akin to a racial caste system could be operating in the United States many years ago. I describe in the introduction to my book that I first encountered the idea that a new racial caste system could exist in the United States when I was rushing to catch the bus. And a bright orange poster caught my eye. It was stapled to a telephone pole. And the poster kind of screamed in, large bold print, "The drug war is the new Jim Crow." And I scanned the text of the flyer for a few minutes, and I saw that a radical community group was holding a meeting in a small church, a few blocks away. The church itself had seating capacity probably for no more than 50 or so people. And they were organizing to protest the new three strikes law in California, the expansion of the prison system, and police brutality. And I remember looking at the poster and thinking to myself, the criminal justice system is racist in a lot of ways, but it doesn't help to make such absurd comparisons. People just think you're crazy. And I crossed the street, ran to catch the bus, hopped on the bus on my way to my new job as director of the Racial Justice Project at the ACLU. Now, when I started working at the ACLU, I assumed that the criminal justice system had problems of racial bias, much in the same way that all institutions in our society today are infected to some degree, you know, with conscious and unconscious racial bias. Prior to joining the ACLU, I had been working as a civil rights attorney litigating large class action employment discrimination cases against companies like Home Depot and public supermarkets in the South. And, you know, I understood well the ways in which racial stereotyping, gender stereotyping can, you know, infect subjective decision making of all kinds at all levels of an organization with disastrous consequences. So I figured I'm just going to shift my attention from employment discrimination to criminal justice reform and, you know, use the same tools and strategies that I had used in the employment discrimination context to criminal justice reform and work with others to, you know, root out racial bias wherever and wherever it might rear its ugly head in the criminal justice system. But by the time I left the ACLU, I realized that I had been wrong about the criminal justice system. It's not just another institution in our society infected with racial bias, but a different beast entirely. You know, the activists that posted that sign on the telephone pole, they weren't crazy, nor were the smattering of lawyers and advocates around the country that were beginning to connect the dots between mass incarceration and earlier forms of racial control. So quite belatedly, really only after years of working on racial profiling litigation, learning about the struggles of people who are incarcerated and released and struggling to find jobs and employment on the outside, only after years of working on these issues and having my own moments of personal awakening did I finally come to see that mass incarceration truly is a stunningly comprehensive and well-disguised form of racial control analogous to Jim Crow. I state my basic thesis in the introduction to my book. I say what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, are all suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. Well, here are a few of the facts that I uncovered in the course of my research and that I cite in my book. More African Americans are under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. In 2004, more African American men were disenfranchised due to felon disenfranchisement laws than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. And in some major urban areas in the United States today, if you take into account prisoners, the majority of working-age African-American men have been branded criminals and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In fact, in 2002, the Urban League released a report showing that in Chicago, the figure is nearly 80%, 80% of working age African American men branded criminals, have criminal records. They are permanently locked into an inferior second class status. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race that can be discriminated against by law for the rest of their lives, much like their grandparents or great-grandparents may have been under an explicitly racial system of control. Now, I find that when I tell people that, you know, I think that mass incarceration amounts to some kind of new system of racial control, I'm kind of usually met with, you know, shock, disbelief. People say, how can you say that? You know, just look at Barack Obama, look at Oprah Winfrey, look at Colin Powell. The list goes on and on of highly visible African Americans in positions of leadership or power who have attained great wealth. And these individuals are offered as proof that we can't possibly have a caste-like system operating in the United States today. But I think it's important to keep in mind that no caste system in the United States has ever governed all African Americans. There have always been free blacks and black success stories, even during slavery and Jim Crow. During slavery, there were some black slave owners, not many, but some. And during Jim Crow, there were some black lawyers and black doctors, not many, you know, but some. You know, the extraordinary nature of individual black achievement today in formerly white domains does indicate that the old Jim Crow system is dead. But it doesn't necessarily mean the end of racial caste. You know, if history is any guide, it may have just taken a different form.
Michelle Alexander at the University of Washington's Law School on April 13th, 2010. Her book is called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Hear her entire speech online at KUOW.org. I'm Jenny Asarno, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Michelle Alexander in a moment. 818 94.9 KUOW. I'm Bill O'Grady. A lawyer with an organization that's been advising protesters on their rights talks about this weekend's G20 conference in Toronto, the massive police presence in the city, which is said to be there to dissuade and control violent protesters from interfering with the summit, but which protesters say feels more like intimidation. Listen for that in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. Leonard Bernstein's name is high on the list of favorite American composers. He's perhaps best known for the music of West Side Story, but Bernstein also wrote symphonies, operas, and movie scores. He was conducting right up until his death in 1990. Seattle Celebrates Bernstein has been a months-long celebration of the maestro and a showcase for Seattle-area artists. This weekend, the Seattle Symphony is holding a celebration of Leonard Bernstein. Conductor Gerard Schwartz worked with and was influenced by Bernstein. Leonard's daughter, Jamie Bernstein, is also in town. Both artists talk about the life and legacy of American musical icon Leonard Bernstein, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Weather outlook for the Seattle-Tacoma-Everett area for tonight. Lows in the 50s, mostly cloudy. Chance of light rain after midnight. Friday highs around 70. Cloudy with a chance of light rain in the morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon. Friday night lows around 50, mostly cloudy. Saturday highs around 70, partly sunny.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jenny Asarno. Close your eyes. Picture a drug dealer. What do you see? If you see an image of a young black man standing on a ghetto street corner, you're not alone. Michelle Alexander says a large percentage of African-American men from inner cities are in the criminal justice system, many of them for drug charges. But Michelle Alexander says black people don't use or sell drugs more than other Americans. She believes the mass incarceration of African Americans amounts to a new racial caste system. Michelle Alexander says there's no question the Jim Crow era is over. Look at Barack Obama. Look at Oprah Winfrey. Alexander says the criminal justice system is different from Jim Crow. It doesn't use racial language. But she believes it still creates what she calls an undercast of Black and Latino Americans. Michelle Alexander is a law professor at Ohio State University. She used to direct the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU of Northern California. She spoke at the University of Washington's Law School on April 13, 2010.
Any honest observer of American racial history has to acknowledge that the rules and reasons the legal system employs to enforce status relations of any kind, well, they evolve and they change as they're challenged. You know, the first chapter of my book is devoted to, you know, describing kind of these cyclical rebirths of racial caste in America. You know, after the collapse of slavery, a convict's leasing system emerged in the South to replace the institution of slavery. There's a fantastic book by Douglas Blackman called Slavery by Another Name that talks about the practice at the end of the Civil War of African-American men being rounded up en masse for minor crimes like loitering, arrested, sent to prisons, and then shipped out to plantations, leased out to plantations. And the idea was that these folks had to kind of earn their freedom, but the catch was they could never earn enough to pay back the cost of their shelter and their food to their plantation owners. And so, you know, they were in perpetual slavery, you know, many years after the supposed collapse of slavery following the Civil War. So a system like slavery emerged as a backlash to the Civil War. And of course, then there was the emergence of Jim Crow as convict leasing began to fade away. Now, most historians imagine that, you know, although Jim Crow and convict leasing systems clearly emerged as a backlash to the collapse of slavery, that no similar system has emerged following the collapse of Jim Crow. But I think if we take a closer look at the way mass incarceration actually operates in communities of color, you know, we're forced to reach a different conclusion. You know, the emergence of mass incarceration has been, you know, truly sudden and dramatic. In a period of, you know, less than 30 years, we went from having a prison population of about 300,000 to more than 2 million. Our nation's prison population quintupled, not doubled or tripled, quintupled, an exceptionally short period of time. You know, the United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of even highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, or Iran. In fact, if we as a nation were to return to the incarceration rates we had in the 1970s, you know, a time when many civil rights activists actually thought that rates of incarceration were egregiously high, but if we were just to go back to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. That's how enormous and deeply entrenched, kind of in the basic economic fabric of our society, that mass incarceration has become in an incredibly short period of time. But in my view, it's the racial dimension of mass incarceration that is the most striking feature. You know, no other country in the world imprisons such a large percentage of its racial and ethnic minorities. You know, several years ago, it was estimated that in Washington, D.C., you know, 3 out of 4 young Black men and nearly all those who lived in the poorest neighborhoods could expect to serve time in prison. You know, rates of incarceration, nearly as shocking, can be found in other urban areas across America. Now, most people assume that this explosion in our prison system, you know, can be explained by crime rates. People say, well, yeah, of course our prison population shot through the roof because of crime. Crime went up, so prison population went up. Not so. You know, crime rates over the last 30 years have fluctuated. fluctuated, risen and fallen over the last 30 years, and today are at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. Most sociologists now agree that rates of incarceration have moved independently of crime rates. Whether crime rates are going up or down, incarceration rates have continued to soar. So, you know, if the prison population hasn't exploded because of crime rates, well, what is it then? Well, it turns out that, you know, the activists who posted the sign on the telephone pole were right. No, the war on drugs is the single most important cause of the prison boom in the United States and the branding of millions of Americans as felons for life. About two-thirds of the increase in the federal system is due to drug convictions, and more than half of the increase in the state system is due to drug convictions. Drug convictions have increased about 1,000% since the drug war first began. And for those who might think that, you know, the target in this war has been violent offenders or drug kingpins, it's not the case. You know, in 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for simple possession. Only 1 out of 5 were for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses today have no history of violence or significant selling activity. You know, and in the 1990s, the period of the greatest expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession. You know, a drug that, you know, many scientists now believe is less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, and a drug that is equally as prevalent in middle-class white communities on college campuses as it is in inner-city communities. But the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, resulting in astronomical increases in incarceration rates, particularly of black and brown men, although increasingly of women. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been black, brown. Now, the reality is that there are almost no differences in drug use or selling activity across racial groups. You know, for decades now, surveys have consistently shown and studies have consistently shown that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. Now, this defies, you know, our basic racial stereotypes about who drug dealers are. You know, when we picture a drug dealer, we typically imagine, you know, a black kid standing on a street corner somewhere, maybe with his pants hanging down. Well, drug dealing happens in the ghetto, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. You know, a kid in rural Nebraska or rural Kansas, he doesn't drive to the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or, you know, whatever. No, he gets it from a friend, classmate, coworker, somebody down the road. Now, it turns out that drug markets in the United States are relatively segregated by race and class, much like American society generally. You know, whites tend to sell to whites, blacks tend to sell to blacks, university students sell to each other. So the concentration of the drug war in poor communities of color cannot be justified by rates of drug crime, drug use, drug sales. Well, why is it being waged there? Well, the drug war from the outset had never much to do with drug crime. It was about racial politics. You know, most people think the war on drugs was launched in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities across America, or rising drug crime. Not true. The current drug war was officially announced by President Ronald Reagan in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually declining, and a couple years before crack first emerged in Los Angeles and later spread to communities of color, inner city communities of color across America. The war on drugs was motivated by racial politics. It was part of the Republican Party's kind of grand strategy, often referred to as the Southern strategy, of attempting to appeal to poor and working class white voters who were resentful of, disaffected by many of the gains of the civil rights movement, particularly busing, desegregation, and affirmative action. Now, many of these folks had good reason to feel concerned about the changes wrought by the civil rights movement. You know, it wasn't kind of rich white folks that had their worlds rocked by desegregation. You know, they were able to send their kids to private schools. No, it was primarily poor and working class white folks who were suddenly, you know, forced to compete on equal terms for scarce jobs. With a group of people that they had long been taught to view as their inferiors. It was their kids who were, you know, facing potential busing orders across time. And there was anxiety and fear wrought by the social upheaval brought by the civil rights movement. Well, Republican Party strategists and pollsters found that they could appeal to those poor and working class white voters through racially coded political appeals on issues of crime and welfare. And through these racially coded political appeals, they could get, you know, white voters, particularly in the South, who had long been kind of members of the Democratic Party, to defect from the Democratic kind of New Deal coalition to the Republican Party. And so these racially coded political appeals and get tough campaigns and law and order rhetoric was part of that strategy of appealing to those voters. And when Ronald Reagan declared the war on drugs at a time when drug crime was actually declining and people weren't that much worried about drug crime, it was an effort to make good on campaign promises to get tough on a group of people that had been defined in the political rhetoric and in the media imagery as black and brown. Now, the Reagan administration got lucky, and a couple years after the war was officially declared, crack hit the streets in Los Angeles and spread to inner city communities, and the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize images of crack babies, crack dealers, crack-related violence, staff whose job it was to feed stories about these folks and find examples of crack babies, crack whores in the inner city to feed to mainstream media outlets. Their hope was that by, you know, publicizing and sensationalizing, you know, crack-related use, abuse, and violence in inner-city communities, that it could boost public support for the drug war and turn the rhetorical war into a literal one. And the plan worked like a charm. Almost overnight, you know, television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug dealers and users. In the mid-1980s and early 1990s, it was nearly impossible to turn on the evening news without seeing images of black and brown men in handcuffs being paraded off to prison for drug-related offenses or sweeps being done of housing projects in ghetto communities. It saturated the news, and it forever changed our conceptions about who drug users and dealers are. And it's because of that media campaign conducted by the Republican administrations and the media imagery that followed that in 1995, a national survey was conducted asking people, close your eyes for a minute and imagine, you know, a drug criminal. 95% of the respondents pictured someone who was African American. Only 5%. You know, pictured anyone of any other race. So it's no surprise that in that political environment that the war would be waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. And Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove that they could be even tougher on them, tougher on, you know, the racially defined others in the media imagery and in the news. And President Clinton outdid Ronald Reagan. He escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessor had even imagined possible. The greatest increase in incarceration rates in, you know, United States history happened during the Clinton administration, not during the Reagan administration, because Clinton was so desperate to appeal to and try to woo that same block of voters that had proved so responsive to the racially charged get tough rhetoric on crime and welfare. And that's why Clinton pledged to end welfare as we know it and escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican counterparts had dreamed possible. So here we are as a result, you know, years after all the media fanfare and the get tough rhetoric, and we have people of all colors, serving lengthy sentences unheard of in other Western democracies for often relatively minor, nonviolent drug-related offenses. You know, if you go to, you know, places in Europe and tell people that here in the United States, there are people doing life sentences for marijuana possession, they'll just look at you like you're crazy. Absolutely unheard of. You know, here in the United States, our Supreme Court upheld life imprisonment for a first-time drug offense. Absolutely unheard of, really, you know, in any other democracy in the world. And the fact that those who are trapped in the new undercast are not only black and brown, but are also white, is a reflection of a drug war and a get tough movement that has spiraled out of control and caused harm to people of all colors. You know, Jim Crow, of course, was a system of rules, laws, policies and customs that, you know, served to lock African Americans in a permanent second class status for life. Well, if you consider whether some of the rules and laws that apply to those labeled felons, and kind of ask yourself whether they remind you of a bygone era.
Michelle Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She is associate professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. She used to direct Stanford's Civil Rights Clinic. She spoke at the University of Washington on April 13, 2010. The Gates Public Service Law Program and the University Bookstore sponsored the event. Hear her entire speech on our website, KUOW.org. I'm Jenny Asarno, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Michelle Alexander's talk continues in a moment. 839, 94.9 KUOW News and Information. I'm Bill O'Grady. The Day That Lehman Died by Matthew Solon is a drama based on the collapse of one of the oldest and largest investment banks in the world, which sparked the global recession. On September 15, 2008, Lehman Brothers filed for the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. It sent the already unstable markets into a tailspin. How did the big beasts of Wall Street make this critical decision? They held in their hands the future, not just of a bank, but the stability of the global financial system. A performance of The Day That Lehman Died in a special presentation tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Horoscopes and tarot cards are among the many ways to try to predict the future. In Cambodia, some people believe they can read the future with some pretty mundane tools like corn, water, alcohol, grass, and an ox. The practice is a mix of Buddhist and Brahmin beliefs. A visit to Cambodia to learn more tomorrow afternoon in the 2 o'clock hour. Weather forecast for the Seattle-Tacoma-Everett area for tonight. Lows in the 50s, mostly cloudy. A chance of light rain after midnight. Friday highs around 70, cloudy with a chance of light rain in the morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon. Friday night lows around 50, mostly cloudy. Saturday highs around 70 degrees, partly sunny skies. Counseling help for Island County veterans. A visit to the Veterans Resource Center on Whidbey Island, set up to provide Island County vets with nearby services like counseling to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. Creativity, Art, and Learning. Specialists in education talk about how important art and creative thinking are in the educational process. And Jobs and the Class of 2010, a look at what the job market's like for recent college graduates. All three of these features next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jenny Asarno. Slavery ended in 1865. Then came convict leasing, sharecropping, Jim Crow segregation laws. And now? Well, according to Michelle Alexander, now we have the criminal justice system. Michelle Alexander is a civil rights lawyer. She made her case at the University of Washington's Law School on April 13, 2010. If you're skeptical of her claim, she asks you to consider the rules and laws that apply to felons.
First and most obviously is denial of the right to vote. You know, I'm thrilled that here in Washington State, you know, that Washington State has now become one of the few states where prisoners, as well as those who have been branded felons, have the right to vote as a result of, you know, legislative action and the decision, hopefully you're all familiar with, by the Ninth Circuit, ruling that the denial of the right to vote to people in prison is a violation of the Voting Rights Act because the criminal justice system, particularly in drug law enforcement in Washington State, is so rife with racial bias and that the racial disparities can't be explained on race-neutral terms. In fact, the state made no attempt to explain them in race-neutral terms, that the denial of the right to vote to prisoners violates the Voting Rights Act. Well, most other states in the United States, that's not the case. And the denial of the right to vote is routine in most states in the United States to people who are prisoners. And then even once you've been released from prison, you can be denied the right to vote for a period of years or for your entire life. Employment discrimination against those branded felons is perfectly legal. Job applications ranging from Burger King clerk to accountant, all got that box on the employment application that you have to check if you've ever been convicted of a felony. You know, studies indicate that 70% of employers won't even consider hiring someone who's been convicted of a drug felony. You know, never mind that most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime, but if you've been branded a felon, if you've been caught with drugs, well, then the odds of you getting employment again are extremely slim if you check that box. Housing discrimination. Housing discrimination is perfectly legal. During the Jim Crow era, of course, that was the era of racially restrictive covenants. But today, housing discrimination is perfectly legal. Public housing projects, as well as private landlords, are not only authorized to discriminate, but in federal public housing, they're required to discriminate. Public housing is off limits to you for a minimum of 5 years once you've been released from prison. So imagine, here you are, released from prison, no money, no job. Public housing is off limits to you. Many homeless shelters today screen for criminal convictions. Where are folks, the 600,000 people released from prison every year? Where are these folks expected to go? Many folks who are released from prison return to the communities from which they came, ghetto communities, and their relatives risk eviction if they allow you to stay with them. So no job, nowhere to sleep. What are you expected to do? Well, in most states, you're expected to pay thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs. Some states you're expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment. Paying back these fees, fines, and court costs are often a condition of your parole. And in fact, in many states, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. To pay back the cost of your imprisonment, accumulated child support, fees, fines, court costs, what do we expect these folks to do? Even if you're one of the lucky few who managed to land a job after checking the box, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished. And you're not even eligible for food stamps. By federal law, thanks to President Clinton, even food stamps are off limits the people who've been branded drug felons, pregnant women, people with HIV, AIDS. You're hungry, sick, can't even get food stamps. Now, what is the system designed to do? You know, from all appearances, it appears designed to send people right back to prison, which is what happens about 70% of the time. 70% of people released from prison return within 3 years. And the majority of those who return do so in a matter of months because the legal hurdles and the barriers to just surviving and making it in the mainstream society and the legal economy are so great. So then we have three strikes laws. You know, here in Washington State, there's someone serving, you know, a life sentence, a three-strike sentence for stealing $50 worth of groceries as their third strike. You know, people are then punished for the rest of their lives, you know, locked up and the keys thrown away for struggling to survive once being branded a felon. Now, of course, there's also other political forms of discrimination analogous to Jim Crow, like exclusion from jury service. You know, one hallmark of the Jim Crow era was the systematic exclusion of African Americans from juries and kind of the all-white juries, particularly in the South. Well, in many areas, all-white juries have been making a roaring comeback. You know why? Because those branded felons are deemed automatically ineligible for jury service. And then get this, even if you haven't been branded a felon, if you've ever had a negative experience with law enforcement, well then, you know, that can disqualify you for cause from a jury in a criminal case because you're perceived to have experiences with law enforcement that would make it difficult, if not impossible, for you to be impartial in a criminal case. So in many areas, you know, the all-white jury and the systematic exclusion of African Americans from jury service has come roaring back because of mass incarceration and the branding of millions of people as felons, frequently for nonviolent and drug-related offenses. But of all of the kind of formal political forms of discrimination and exclusion that are in place today for those branded felons, you know, in my experience, those who've been branded felons will often say that these legal rules, these legal forms of discrimination are not the worst of it. That the worst is actually the stigma and shame that you bear as being viewed as a criminal, being branded a felon. It's not just the denial of the job, but the look that flashes across the employer's face when he sees that box has been checked. You know, the shame and the stigma associated with criminality in the era of mass incarceration has real parallels to the shame and stigma of race in the Jim Crow era. During Jim Crow, you know, light-skinned blacks would often try to pass as white to avoid the shame and stigma associated with race. Well, today, you know, those branded felons often lie not just to employers and, you know, to housing officials, but also to their friends, family, and loved ones trying to hide their criminal status or that of their family members due to shame. You know, there's a fascinating study that was done in Washington, D.C., of an area, you know, hard hit by mass incarceration, a neighborhood where, you know, every house or every other apartment had someone who, you know, had either been recently released from prison or had a family member behind bars. And these were neighborhoods where you would think that mass incarceration was just, you know, completely normalized. But instead, the ethnographers found that not a single person in this study had fully come out to their friends, neighbors, loved ones about their own criminal history or criminal status or that of their loved ones. That there was still such shame and stigma associated with it that people felt it'd be better not to mention it, to keep quiet. So there's an eerie silence that has fallen over even the communities hardest hit by mass incarceration. You know, one rooted in shame, you know, for some, and for others of us, in denial. Now, we are in deep denial as a nation about the existence of caste in America and the experience of millions of people cycling in and out of the criminal justice system today. Now, you know, a big part of this denial is rooted in the fact that prisoners are literally erased from poverty statistics and unemployment statistics. You know, prisoners are just not even counted. In fact, if you read unemployment statistics for African Americans, you read, you know, unemployment for African Americans is 15% or whatever the current number is. Well, you can actually add 15, 20, up to 23 percentage points to that number to account for all of the African Americans behind bars. So this illusion of great progress has been engineered in part by the removal of millions of people from our poverty rolls, from our unemployment statistics through mass incarceration. You know, in affirmative action, you know, the election of Barack Obama has helped to create kind of a happy face on America's racial reality. But if you take a look, a close look at the data and include prisoners within it, you see that African Americans as a group are actually not better off than they were in 1968 when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated and uprisings swept inner city communities across America. We are today much in the same place that we were when Martin Luther King Jr. said we need to build a poor people's movement in the United States and join, you know, poor folks of all colors in a struggle for basic human rights. And that, I believe, is the work that is left unfinished and that we must go back to do, not just to end mass incarceration, but to do the healing work and the movement building work that is necessary to end the history of racial caste in America and build a society that genuinely recognizes and honors the human rights of all. The comment, for those of you who may not have been able to hear, was that, you know, black and brown women, African American and Latina are affected now as much as men of color by the war on drugs and mass incarceration, and that this Get Tough movement has resulted in younger and younger people being, you know, charged as adults and, you know, labeled felons at earlier and earlier ages as well. And, you know, both of those points are very well taken. In fact, women are the fastest growing sector of the prison population today, African-American women and Latinas. And their incarceration, you know, I fear will have even more drastic consequences for community than the incarceration of black and brown men. Why? Well, because, you know, these communities are already so fragile because of the absence of so many black men. And to begin removing the women and the mothers of the children, those who have, you know, historically been the primary caretakers, is to relegate generations of children to the foster care system. And the data of, you know, what happens to kids once they're released from foster care is, you know, just tragic and really sobering. I mean, at least in California, you know, the majority of kids, you know, who are released from foster care at the age of 18 wind up in prison in less than 3 years. So really, you're sentencing those children when you incarcerate their mothers. You are sentencing those children to a lifetime of institutionalization. So I am deeply concerned about the trend of targeting women for relatively minor drug offenses and the consequences that has for families. And I want to share with you just one story. There's a woman named Susan Burton who I met, you know, just a few months ago, who now runs a number of homes for women recently released from prison. Now, Susan, many years ago, was standing in her front yard when she witnessed a police officer killing her son, ran him over with a police car. The car was barreling down her street, and her son was 5-year-old son was run over. Now, she spiraled into deep depression and grief. If she had been wealthy, she might have been able to get legal drugs prescribed to her to help her cope, right? She would have been able to get a psychiatrist. She would have had good health care coverage, get a psychiatrist, give her good legal drugs. Well, that didn't happen. She didn't have that. And she became addicted to illegal drugs. And as a result, she cycled in and out of prison 6 times. Finally, she was able to get into a drug treatment program in Santa Monica, got clean, and committed herself to ensuring that no other woman would ever have to go through what she suffered as a result. And so she one morning woke up and went down to Skid Row, which is where they let prisoners off the prison bus. You're left off, you know, get off the bus just carrying your cardboard box with your belongings, get off the bus with nowhere to go, often little money. She would meet women at the bus and say, just come home with me, you know, sleep in my dining room or sleep on my couch and have a safe place. And she began doing that, and now she's running 5 houses for women, often with children. And I toured these houses, and, you know, there's bunk beds and, you know, kids' toys scattered around, and here are these women struggling to make it on the outside for their families and to hold their families together. And if they slip up, tiniest slip up, they can find themselves right back in prison again, and their hopes of being able to raise their children are likely gone forever. And as for younger people being, you know, branded felons and treated as adults, you're absolutely right that the Get Tough movement, the law and order kind of frenzy that overtook the United States has resulted not only in the drug war, but right, 3 strikes laws and the treating of youth as adults. It's been this punitive impulse rather than a compassionate one. And, you know, I would argue that this punitive impulse is largely due to the fact that when we think about criminals, we tend to think about folks of color. And it is our failure as a nation to have the same care, compassion, and concern for kids in the ghetto as, you know, you might for white suburban kids that has resulted in these incredibly harsh approaches to dealing with problems of youth crime. And, you know, youth commit crimes. That's part of being young in America to a large extent. I think there's very few folks in this room who did not violate the law in some way when they were young, drinking underage, experimenting with drugs, speeding on the freeway. You know, we are all criminals. But only some of us get branded, and only some of us get relegated to a permanent second-class status for life. And in America, it's primarily youth of color that suffer that fate.
Michelle Alexander is Associate Professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Her book is called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The Gates Public Service Law Program brought Michelle Alexander to the University of Washington on April 13, 2010. The university bookstore co-sponsored her talk. John O'Brien recorded it. Hear it all on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. I'm Jenny Asarno, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington, celebrating 75 years of standing up for fairness and equality and protecting America's values of liberty and justice for all. ACLU-WA.org. The ACLU, leading freedom forward. 9 o'clock, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater. I'm Bill O'Grady. A multifaceted